it didn't even make the top 10 for ABC, CBS, or CNN. But number one for NBC is number one news story covered. I wonder why that was. Well, guess who had the rights to air the Summer Olympics that summer? CNBC. They used their nightly news as a platform to hype the viewership for the ads. And occasionally they have an event interspersed between the ads for the Summer Olympics. But it's a blatant misuse of journalism and journalistic values. Likewise, what we've seen in the last decade is a real turn to inexpensive, trivial celebrity stories. You know the litany. JonBenet, O.J., Buttafuoco, the guy who got his pecker chopped off. What is his name? John Wayne Bobbitt. I mean, we know this. We can't name the president of France, but we know John Wayne Bobbitt. I mean, that's where we're at. 1995 was my favorite year. They did the thing of the 10 most covered stories in the news media in 1995. And it was like O.J. Simpson, the Long Island Lolita, Tanya Harding. You get the drift. I mean, it's Empire of the Senseless. And then my favorite story, 1999, John F. Kennedy Jr. dies. John F. Kennedy Jr. dies. Now, granted, you know, he was a better person than all of us. He is the Messiah. He is the greatest human who ever lived. We pale by comparison. So it's appropriate that our cable news channels would take 10 days and cover no other story but his death. Now, I had a student who studied this. I mentioned this in an earlier talk, who did a content analysis and found out that the death of John F. Kennedy Jr. got more attention than the death of John F. Kennedy Sr. He was only the president. John F. Kennedy Jr. was a private citizen. He didn't hold any public office. He was a media-made People magazine celebrity, and they covered him with more coverage than almost any other story imaginable. They turned our televisions into virtual aquariums for 10 days. No other story was covered. That's extraordinary. Why do they do that? Because it's inexpensive, it's cheap, it's not controversial. Those stories are great. It gives the illusion of controversy. Yeah, well, Cato Kaelin, hey, looks hungover today. Whoa, that's pretty controversial. Here's what Cato Kaelin looks like. I mean, it's just not a story, but it gives the illusion of all this sort of tension without really providing the real thing, real controversy. There's plenty to report on that would be very controversial, but that gets your feet in hot water. That's what good journalism does. That's what's off limits increasingly. And then, of course, there's my favorite subject, local television news. You know, Wally knows this line, but, I mean, it's true. We talk in this country about how divided the country is now. People speak different languages, they wear different clothes, they have different nose rings, root for different sports teams, they listen to different music. Nothing seems to unite us. We're a divided country. Well, in my travels around the country, I found the one thing that unites all Americans, our common thread. And that all Americans that I've met agree or think, what they agree on, is every American thinks their local TV news is the worst in the country. That's the one thing they all agree on. Because local TV news has no journalism whatsoever. In fact, there's a guy, Paul Kruhl, I think his name is, I can't remember the exact last name, in Denver, who filed a suit with the Federal Trade Commission saying that the local TV news stations in Denver should stop calling it news because it's false labeling because there's no journalism content. And he's right. Another way we see the effect of this journalism, what's happened to journalism, is in the marketing of news in the last 15 years. The owners of these big companies look at the journalism over here and they're saying, you know, what's this mumbo-jumbo about serving the entire population? That doesn't make sense. Our advertisers aren't interested in poor people. Why the hell are we reporting on poor people? Get them out of here. 86 of them. What we've seen is the elimination of the bottom third to the bottom half of the population from journalism in this country, pretty much by and large. Their interests. Pardon? Well, yeah, from life, but I'm talking about journalism now. But the two go hand in hand. Because if you're purged from one, you're purged from the other. I'm glad you're paying attention. I saw you falling asleep earlier, and I was worried about that. You look at newspapers, for example. I was raised in Cleveland, Ohio. In fact, I have the honor of being the youngest paper boy in the history of Cleveland, Ohio. I was 9 years old when I got my first root. And at one time, newspapers would serve the entire city. I mean, not actually, but I mean, they actually envisioned themselves as serving an entire community. Increasingly, what you find with major daily newspapers, if you go to Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, is it's very difficult to find them in the poorest parts of the city, in the African-American neighborhoods, Latino neighborhoods, the immigrant neighborhoods. But you go to the wealthy suburbs, the upper middle-class neighborhoods, they're hurling them at you. You can't miss them. newspapers are increasingly pitched, written off the bottom third, bottom half of the population. Cable television news. I look at the advertisers for it. It's basically written out the bottom half of the population. Most of them don't subscribe to cable. It's increasingly pitched to the top half, top third. I mean, what you've seen in a lot of cases is that business news has merged with regular news. I mean, they've been morphed. I mean, now business news equals regular news. They're almost interchangeable. They're so commonly done together on Fox News Service and MSNBC. Labor news is all but dropped from the equation. It used to be just 50 years ago, there were roughly 1,000 full-time labor correspondents in American daily newspapers. Now, the newspapers weren't pro-labor, but they covered it as a beat. Working-class people were important. You know how many labor reporters there are in American news media today? Zero. You're a cynic. Two that I know of, and they'll probably not, it won't be two very long, but we have a ton of business reporters. Business is the fast-growing section of the newspapers. It's a spectacular class bias. When the Flint sit-down strike took place in 1937 that established the modern trade union movement, that established the UAW, it should be, in my opinion, it's a national holiday. I mean, it created the American middle class. I mean, it was a great moment in American history. It was a front-page story in every newspaper in the country, including the Chicago Tribune, which hated labor. They had five labor reporters covering it from Flint. It was just a story. It was news. It was important to people's lives. We had the next biggest sit-down strike in American history 50-some years later in Pittstown, Virginia. Probably not too far from here. You remember it, Wally? 1989. It got no press coverage at all. It couldn't have been more stark and more different. In fact, it got so surreal that a bunch of Siberian coal miners came over here to show solidarity to support the Americans, workers. And that was the only time they got an article. The New York Times did a piece saying, boy, it's sort of goofy here. Now the Russians are coming over here to support our workers. You know, what's going on here? It got no coverage, though, because labor is pretty much dropped from view. During the Florida debacle in 2000, there was a really this casual thing that happened that sort of set it all. The commentator at the CNN offices said thank you to the correspondent from the field, and they said, now we're going to go to a commercial, and when we come back from the commercial, we'll see how all this is affecting our stock portfolios. And she didn't say that with any, just of course. Our viewers have stock portfolios. Our viewers have SUVs and computers and go to Europe. This is who we do the news for, people like that, not people down there. They're not in our world. They're not part of it. The class bias is pronounced and it's severe, and it's not because they're bad people. It's rational business. If you were simply a shareholder and you were out to maximize return, you'd do exactly that. That would just make perfect business sense. The problem with our media system is it lets people, rich people, wealthy corporations, control our media system to suit their self-interest. It doesn't serve our interest. The problem is the structure of the system. Now, there's still some very good work that's done. In fact, there's some outstanding journalism that's done. You see it all the time. The problem we're seeing increasingly, and this gets to the crisis we face, is there's no echo effect. Morton Mintz, a great reporter for the Washington Post, an investigative reporter, did an article a couple years ago that was really striking. He went around and he found great investigative reports in a lot of newspapers around the country, not big city newspapers oftentimes, sometimes like regional papers. And what he found was they'd run these great damning exposés, but then there'd be no follow-up. No one else would go after it. You wouldn't see other newspapers send three more reporters in to follow-up. It'd run once or once a couple times and then die. And there'd be no political action on it. There would be no political action on it. It wouldn't lead to reform. You know, just the PR people would have to gloss it over, but whatever it was, the expose was on, it didn't change anything. And what Mintz argued, and I think he's absolutely right, that, the crisis of our journalism is also a crisis of our democracy. We often talk about a democracy needs journalism. Well, journalism needs democracy. If you're reporting on some malfeasance, and you can report it, and then nothing happens because the political system is so absolutely corrupt, you can't really have journalism either. And that's the situation we're in today. Our political system, the corruption there is so immense. By historical standards, it's approaching any level of corruption we've ever had in our history, if not exceeding it, that it puts journalism in a very difficult spot. Because you can do exposés, but they simply fall through the floor because no one pays attention. It doesn't change anything. That's how severe the corruption is. That's a big difference from 30 years ago. That's a big difference from 40 years ago to today. Our media is no longer a corrective to the corruption of our politics and our economy. Our media are part of the problem. They're entrenched within it. I'll give you a couple of examples. First, let's talk about our elections, the crisis we face in electoral democracy in this country. Our elections are pathetic. They're a farce. Let truth be told, the election system we had in this country took place in a country we don't like. Iraq had elections like ours, an electoral system. We'd be all over their butts. How could they call that democracy? It's an utter farce, what we call electoral democracy is going to. Consider this. Consider the situation we're in now. Television advertising, political ads, have become the lingua franca of political discourse in this country. The amount spent on TV political ads and the amount spent on political campaigns have increased by 40% every 4 years going back to the 80s. Last election in 2000, over $1 billion was spent just on TV political ads, $3 billion on the federal elections alone. That's a lot of money. It takes a lot of money to run for office. And most of this money goes to pay for ads on the public airwaves, stations that get the licenses for no charge, then make a fortune selling these ads. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, consider the content of these ads. Robert Spiro, former head of creative for Ogilvy & Mather, one of the most leading creative advertising people in the country, he hated political advertising. He'd go to parties in New York, and people would come up to him and say, oh, you're in advertising. Yeah, well, political advertising, that's really bad. It's just like selling beer. He thought beer ads had dignity compared to political ads. So he took a year off from his job, and he did a content analysis of every single presidential TV political ad. This is like 20 years ago. In history. He took a year off and he wrote a book called The Duping of the American Voter. And he argued successfully that if any one of those ads had to come up and face the same regulation that a commercial ad he did face, all of them would be found fraudulent. He went through each ad to show where they were fraudulent. They were just lies. They're flat out lies or half truths, but they're misleading. They're an insult to our intelligence. That's not the half of it. Where does the money come from to pay for these ads? That's part of the problem, too. Where does this $1 billion come from? Well, now we've got campaign finance reform, right? Whoopee-doo. Hey, 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 now we're free. No, quite the contrary. What campaign finance reform does is it doubled the amount of hard money that can be given per candidate. So instead of $2,000 per election, primary and general, it's now $4,000. Consider that. We know that over 90% of the money in hard money to date that goes to candidates comes from the wealthiest 1% of Americans. Over 90% of it comes from the wealthiest 1% of Americans, Republicans, Democrats. You wonder why both parties are in favor of the WTO? Go no further than that figure right there. 90% of the money comes from the wealthiest 1% of Americans. We just doubled the maximum amount. How many people giving $25, some steel workers giving $25, hey, they've doubled the maximum amount. Oh, great for me. I'll give $6,000 next time. Or $4,000. Of course not. It only affects those who were maxed out already, the top 0.25% in our population for the most part. And it's only going to make the problem worse. It's a very serious problem. Add to that the fact that as the TV political ads have become the lingua franca of our media, of our political campaigns, and the reliance upon the wealthy to pay for them has become ever more great, the amount of coverage on TV has plummeted. The amount of actual electoral coverage of candidates, if you're a citizen in the community, you turn on the TV and you want to know who's running for governor and you want to hear the debates in the TV news, forget it. It's over. One study of the California gubernatorial election found there was a 90% drop-off in local TV news of the California gubernatorial race between 1974 and 1998. There was virtually no coverage at all on local TV news in California of their gubernatorial race in 1998. They called it the first all-commercial election. It was just tens, hundreds of millions of dollars spent on these inane ads. That's what politics was all about. A friend of mine, Ed Garvey, ran for governor of Wisconsin in 1998. Ed was the Democratic candidate, the nominee. And he would go into cities in Wisconsin, and he'd hold a press conference, and no media would come. No television stations would come. And he would say, why aren't you covering this? You know, the election's in 6 weeks. I'm talking about the issues. I'm the Democratic candidate. And the station owners would be blunt with him and say, you want to be taken seriously? Buy an ad. You know, you want to get in there? Buy an ad. We're not going to give you a freebie. Buy an ad. That was their attitude. They probably wouldn't say that for attribution. But that's what they told him directly. And this is where the press plays a crucial role. Now, the role of journalism can be to go along with that process or to fight it, to arrest it. Journalists can say, yeah, that's the way it is, and we think that's fine. Or they can say, that's the way it is, and that's wrong. What could journalists do? For one thing, they do, they make a point of making sure they give as much coverage as possible to candidates who don't have a lot of money, to really take the power of money out of our electoral process. Just give candidates who aren't rich, give them as much attention, if not more attention. Balance it the other way. Instead, they could then be a powerful corrective on corruption. Of course, they aren't going to do that on TV or they'll lose their job. That's simply not going to be acceptable. But print media, why not do it there? Why can't print journalists go out of their way? Instead, however, our news media have chosen to reinforce this corrupt system in spades. One need only consider the Nader race in 2000 and the press coverage of that race to see how this worked. On June 30th of 2000, the New York Times ran an editorial on the Nader campaign. I still remember it almost verbatim. It was so striking. The editorial wasn't written to you and me. It was written to every other newspaper in the country. It was meant to every other journalist. And what the New York Times said basically, we're not going to cover this guy. You shouldn't either. He's off limits. He's not a legitimate candidate. And if you do cover him, any of you other newspapers, you have to answer to us and the Washington Post, the deans, the watchdogs of journalism in this country. And the New York Times coverage of Nader in 2000 during his presidential race was, I think, roughly equivalent to the coverage that Andrei Sakharov got in Izvestia in the 1970s. And I'm not exaggerating because I followed it very closely. I've studied it. I mean, he got treated in an unbelievable manner. Now, you might not like Ralph Nader. You might think he's a bad guy. He never got married. He's got some problems. I don't, this dubious character. But the fact of the matter is, Ralph Nader has a record of public service that's largely unrivaled in our society. He has a knowledge of the issues that's mind-boggling, if you ever talk to the guy. I mean, he studies encyclopedias for kicks. He knows issues like no one else in this country. He has a record of public service and a standard of integrity that can't be matched. But he was not deemed a legitimate candidate. Donald Trump said, I'm thinking about running for president, and got more coverage probably in the news media in a couple of weeks when he was dabbling about it, because they were thinking, yeah, we'll spend $1 billion in TV ads. That's what the problem, the corruption, you got to buy your way in to be taken seriously, and our news media reinforce it, they don't challenge it. It's a severe problem. And finally, let me turn to the last issue, because I know it's gone on a little longer than I wanted to, but it may be the most important issue I could possibly talk to, which is the current world war against evildoers that we're in the midst of. You know, when the 9/11 terrorist attacks took place, journalists were faced with a classic dilemma in this country. This country in the last 100 years has had roughly 75 foreign wars. We don't know about most of them. A lot of them are these sort of quickie carpet bombings you don't even hear about anymore in our news media, just to blow out some country. But sometimes they require troops, sustained involvement, lots of money, and they require a lot of press coverage. World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, you know, these aren't the sort of things you can slide by. You need to get troops to go willing to put their butts on the line. You need to get a lot of money from the government, from the taxpayers to pay for these wars. And if we look at the way these wars have been handled in the press and how they've been conducted in the U.S., that's actually something you find that's fairly striking of all our major wars since 1914. Every single one of them, the government in power, the president in power, the White House in power, has lied to the American people to get us in that war. Every single one of them. That's the track record. It's just blatant. It's not a debated issue. Even FDR in the late 30s and early 40s wanted to get us into that war. He didn't think if he told the truth, the American people would go into that war. He lied. He did everything in his power to get us in that war. Woodrow Wilson in 1916 ran as the candidate of peace. He kept us out of war. That was his slogan. He won re-election. While he was making that slogan, he was planning to get us into World War I. He got us into it in 1917. 1964, LBJ ran for president as the peace candidate. He wouldn't get us into war in Vietnam. Oh, that Barry Goldwater, he's a kook. He'll be dropping A-bombs in Hanoi. Don't vote for him. You want peace? You vote for me. We now know, and it's almost painful to read the diaries that have come out of LBJ and the recordings and the transcripts of his White House in 1964. He fully planned to get us fully into the war. He knew he just couldn't tell the truth to the American people and win the election. He wouldn't want to take that chance. But he had to lie to the American people to get them to go to that war. He lied through his teeth. The Pentagon Papers showed that. Because he wanted to go to that war for whatever reason he wanted to do that. This is the thing that journalists, we teach this in journalism schools. These are the dark moments of American journalism. These are the sort of things we say, this is really our journalism failed us here. World War I was a senseless slaughter. Vietnam, I bet there are people in this room like myself who lost close relatives there. Senseless slaughter. If our journalism had done those jobs, those lives wouldn't have been lost. It failed us. This is the lesson we tell journalists. So how does it handle World War III, the permanent war against secret evildoers? How does the journalism handle it? Well, what sort of debate was there? What sort of tough questions were given to people in power as they said they had to have this permanent war against evildoers? It was atrocious. By even the most rudimentary standards of journalism, it was appalling. In fact, on CNN this morning, again, they were really on a roll today. They were talking about how they might have to raise more money to pay for the war. And they said on the screen, the headline for the story was Freedom's Price Tag. I thought that must be comforting to the people of Iraq to know that this is Freedom's Price Tag, or Venezuela or Colombia or whatever countries where the evildoers are, next to be nailed. Where was the skepticism towards the war claims? The logical question is, when someone wants to go to war, the most important thing a government can do, journalists have to double their vigilance, not reduce it. That's when you need them most to ask the tough questions. Where was the skepticism towards this blank check for 50-year war against invisible enemies that would just trust them to find? It was hardly there whatsoever. In fact, the reason for this is clear, the sources. The Democrats didn't provide any opposition. So no reporter had 30 Democratic senators protesting. They were all marching in lockstep. So the journalism marched in lockstep. War was the only possible alternative. Cokie Roberts, one of our legendary journalists, on the day the war began, was asked, is there any opposition to the war in the country on ABC? And her response was, none that mattered. None that mattered. And I think she nailed it right on the head. None that mattered. And I think that settled it for Cokie. I want to understand, the point isn't that you should be anti-war. The point is, in a democracy, the decision to go to war has to be made with critical informed dissent. It's the most crucial decision we make. It cannot be made in this sort of manner. You know, consider one of the issues that was completely off the table. It was not mentioned, to my knowledge, by a single journalist in this country, but would have been mentioned if any other country had been in the situation. I'll give you an example. Imagine if bin Laden, instead of taking out the World Trade Center, it said, well, you know, I don't like those Russians. I was fighting some in the 80s. They're a bunch of losers. I'm going to take out the Kremlin, and I'm going to take out the Hermitage in St. Petersburg. I'm just going to nuke their favorite, their landmarks, too. And did that instead of the United States. They got a couple, you know, jetliners in Russia and blasted out the Kremlin and a couple other structures. And let's say as a result of that, President Putin said, well, because of this, we're declaring a 50-year war on evildoers, where we're going to pick all the bad guys in the world, anyone who doesn't support us is an evildoer. What if he had said that? Well, you know what our journalists would have said, among other things? The first thing a good journalist would have said, well, Deke Putin, you've got a huge military-industrial complex that doesn't have an excuse to exist. This is their excuse to have a paycheck for the next 50 years. You've got this enormously self-interested body in your country that wants a war, that wants permanent war. And it's true, he does. And that would have been a good question to ask. No one asked that question in this country. I mean, the third loudest noise, the second loudest noise in Washington on 9/11 were the champagne corks going off in the part of the Pentagon that didn't get nailed. I hate to say it, that's the truth. These people, this is their heaven on earth. Getting a permanent war, $450 billion budget for the next generation, these guys were looking at unemployment lines. They're looking, we don't have an excuse. Colin Powell in 1991 told the Toronto Star in an interview, hey, we're running out of bums. We're running out of people to be our enemies. You know, sort of like Joe Lewis's Bum of the Month Club. They needed some real enemies to justify having a permanent war economy any further. They didn't have any. Now they've got them. The best enemies imaginable. Invisible. You know, any time, hey, are we winning the war? Well, we don't know. Oh, someone set off a firecracker in Uzbekistan. Uh-oh, another $50 billion. You don't know. The terrorists are coming. It's an absurd situation. It's like we're driving in a fog at 80 miles an hour. Or 100 miles an hour, not knowing where we're going. Not even if there's a road in front of us. We have to take our maximum leader's word for it. For a democracy, this is unacceptable. And that's even if you agree with the war, journalism cannot abide by this sort of national security state. It makes a mockery of self-government. And the truth of the matter is, and we know this from history, any war that's fought like this will invariably be a bad war. A war has to be justified. It has to be held accountable. War makers have to be held accountable. In the Civil War, they didn't give Lincoln a blank check. They were on his butt the whole war to justify that they kept that war going. That's how it should be in a war. You've got to justify it. Explain why we have to take out all these countries all of a sudden. We haven't had that at all. It's been an extraordinarily dark day. Now, the problems with the World War on evildoers have been compounded by the complete public ignorance of public foreign affairs in this country. I mean, it's embarrassing. My wife's Norwegian, and I go back to Norway periodically. You can find some wino in Oslo who knows more about the world than most any American, including PhDs. It's appalling how little Americans know about the world. Yet we're sort of giving a blank check for this world war on terrorism. And you can't blame Americans. I mean, how would they know it? Unless they have ESP. They're certainly not going to learn it from their news media. They're not learning it in their educational system. They're completely unprepared by our news media to be citizens of the world, to make these sort of decisions. And then they're not given a chance to make those decisions. And finally, on this point, it's worth noting that the largest media firms that cover this war are all, both print and broadcast, aggressively lobbying the Bush administration for changes in media ownership regulations so they can merge with each other and get bigger, so newspapers can merge with television networks. This is a big thing that they've been working on. So you have the absurd situation that the same media that's praising America's new war and the battle for freedom, on one hand, is lobbying the same government for all sorts of billion-dollar price tag gifts of deregulation. I mean, once again, if this was another country, we'd be considered a scandal. And this country is not even mentioned. It passes right beneath the radar. Finally, the last point I'll talk about, and I wish I had more time, but I'm going to stop, is Enron. And I'm only going to say a couple things about it. Enron, in my view, is every bit as important as the 2000 election, every bit as important as 9/11, because it goes right to the heart of the corruption of our political economy. It lifts the rock on the myth of some sort of free market new economy and exposes the way corporations sleazily rip off workers, buy off politicians, screw over consumers to make their quick bucks and then get away with it. The Enron scandal, I mean, there, in the mid-90s, people were exposing what Enron was doing by buying off politicians and screwing over the energy policies in California, other countries, other states. But it wasn't a news story. In fact, as recently as a year ago, or a year and a half ago, Enron was called the Model New Economy Corporation. It got kid gloves treatment in our news media. We were unprepared for the scandal. Now that this scandal has hit and Enron's gone bankrupt, has it become our Dreyfus affair? Has it become our affair to make us question the relationship of our most powerful government figures and our politicians and our large corporate figures? It should have done that, because that's exactly what it's about. That's what this story is about. Have we had a debate over how to get rid of that corruption so that never happens again? No, we haven't had the debate. It's been converted into a pure business story. You know, some Arthur Anderson guy shredded the papers and bad on them. We aren't going to give them a promotion. It's a business story about some dubious accountants who messed with the numbers. The political side of this, which is the whole story, Enron's whole scheme is a political Ponzi scheme, has dropped from view. The political corruption implicit has fallen. And the reason for that, go back to sources. Enron bought off everyone. It's an equal opportunity briber. Joe Lieberman's got a big fat wallet thanks to Enron. So does Tom Daschle. George W. Bush has a really big fat one. Dick Cheney can't even get in his pants. But the fact of the matter is, they're all in bed with this. None of them wants the sort of Dreyfus affair expose because they'd all go down with it. The whole system would go down. It would require a major reform, a cleansing equal to the progressive era of the New Deal to address this built-in corruption into our political system. Now, people say when they hear me talk, man, I'm depressed. You've really bummed me out. It's impossible. Life sucks. And they say, why aren't you depressed? Why aren't you getting bothered? And I'm like Wally in this regard. I'm not depressed primarily because I see the extent these companies go to keep us from having this discussion. I see the extent they go to make sure there's no public debate over these issues because they know what I know, which is when people hear about the stuff, they get outraged. When people hear about this stuff, they want to change it. They don't. When they understand they have the right, the duty to change media, they're willing to do it. And that's why the media corporations do everything in power. There's no public debate. They don't even want a congressional debate. They want it behind the 10 locked steel doors at the FCC with just them and the other fat cats and no press coverage. That's their idea of democracy. And if we rip down those steel doors, they know that their system won't hold up to the light of day. And that's what we have to do, is shine the light of day on it. And only good things can possibly happen. I mean, I'll leave you really with a quote from one of my favorite writers, Noam Chomsky. It's one of my favorite quotes by Noam. You know, because he deals with a lot of people who say, well, I just don't think it's possible. It's too intense. You know, the problem of changing this world is just not worth it. I mean, kill yourself. The people in power are so strong. And Noam says, you know, the choice is yours. I mean, basically, you've got to look in the mirror, look in your eyes in that mirror, and look deep into your soul, what you're made of. And the choice, you know, if you've got to deal with is if you act like there's no hope of change for the better, you guarantee there's no hope for change for the better. Thank you very much.
Professor Robert McChesney of the University of Illinois, speaking in 2002 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. As we just heard, commercial sponsorship of media has led to media companies consciously pitching their programming to people with disposable income. This is a well-documented fact. What occurs to me is that the presence of advertising necessitates not only people with money, but people who are easily manipulated. The basic message of advertising is that buying the product will change your miserable, frustrated life into a happy one, though you are a neutered, declawed pussycat who will spend 50 years working in a cubicle, doing something that means nothing to you and kissing ass for the privilege, you will suddenly become a tiger, wild, free, and proud behind the wheel of the advertiser's newest model car, etc. Programming that develops critical and independent thinking will never appear in an advertising-driven media. To become involved in the media reform movement, visit on the web mediareform.net. Next, we're going to the world of scientific research with another reading from our ongoing series from the book Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt, written in the year 2000. Schmidt was a writer and editor of Physics Today for 19 years. He was fired from his job after he published this book that examines the unacknowledged ideological nature of professional work and the system of credentialing that serves to place obedient thinkers in society's most creative and influential fields of work. Today, I'm reading from Chapter 4, titled Assignable Curiosity. Wanted: PhD scientist to work as self-directed seeker of truth. Successful candidate will determine own work topics. Excellent laboratory and computer facilities. Competitive salary and benefits package. Scientists will tell you in a second that this job ad is fictitious. Yet many of the same scientists will turn around and tell you that they are self-directed. What's the reality? What determines the topic that individual scientists work on? Answering the question about scientists is important for understanding the politics of professional work in general, because scientists constitute a kind of baseline. Salaried doctors, lawyers, accountants, engineers, and so on are certainly no freer than scientists in deciding what problems they will take on at work. So if the scientist's curiosity is externally directed, then whose isn't? To ask who determines the topics that individual scientists work on is to ask who in society scientists serve in their work. This is not only a fascinating question in and of itself, it is also crucial to understanding the politics of professional qualification in science. For only by understanding the actual role that the rank-and-file scientist plays in society can one make sense of the criteria by which an individual is deemed qualified to work as a scientist. To see who determines research topics for physicists, we must look at industry, government, and universities, the institution that each year hires almost all of the 1,100 to 1,300 people who receive Ph.D. degrees in physics from U.S. universities. Upon graduation, many of the degree recipients get temporary jobs known as postdoctoral fellowships, in order to gain further research experience and be in a position to get a good permanent job. These short-term appointments are usually limited to 1, 2, or 3 years, and are usually at universities or federally funded research and development centers such as Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico. The postdoc typically works extremely long hours assisting in an already established research project directed by a professor or research group leader. There is little pretense that the postdoc has much of a say in defining the topic of investigation. As a result, the experience is often disappointing. One university postdoc wrote the following assessment on an American Physical Society survey questionnaire. Quote, "The postdoc has become a plentiful and captive source of cheap labor for doing the research of and advancing the careers of established academic people while offering little or no opportunities for advancement to the participants, and making it more difficult for the participants to later find permanent work in a different field where professional prospects may be more promising. Close quote. Graduates who don't become postdocs often go directly into potentially permanent jobs. Most of these jobs are in industry, and the rest are in academic institutions and government. Industrial scientists get their research topics from their employers' programs of research projects. These programs, in turn, grow out of the company's quest to develop profitable new products and their need to update old products threatened by technological advances elsewhere in the world. Also, industry performs $23 billion worth of research and development annually for the Department of Defense. This lucrative work can add to a corporation's list of topics to assign its scientists. A look at the General Electric Company's main research and development facility illustrates how industrial scientists get their research topics. More than 500 PhD scientists and engineers play out their careers at GE's Research and Development Center in Schenectady, New York. The stated purpose of this 1 million square foot facility, which is one of the world's largest industrial laboratories, is to undertake work that, quote, promises both to advance knowledge and to pay off for General Electric, close quote. In practice, however, payoff for General Electric takes precedence over the effort to advance knowledge. In the blunt words of Roland W. Schmidt, speaking when he was GE's senior vice president for research and development and boss of the Schenectady facility, if it has no payoff for General Electric, it should not be done at all. He added, I can't truthfully say that all our work advances knowledge. Most people don't expect corporations to fund unprofitable research. But they may nevertheless think of scientists as people who build their careers by following the dictates of their unfettered curiosities, not by devoting themselves to topics chosen to meet the goals like payoff for General Electric. Those who buy this image of scientists might expect GE to have a hard time getting its scientists to sacrifice their own research interests in favor of the company's research interests. As it turns out, GE finds it quite easy to circumscribe in this way the careers of its scientists. The company simply makes its technical needs known, and the scientists, through a process of self-adjustment, get interested in the appropriate topics. You can't select problems for true scientists, much less tell them how to attack the problems, but you can make sure that they are fully informed of the needs of the company businesses that pay the bill, explained the GE research boss. Industrial scientists who are not content being directed by the needs of the company businesses, market forces, and the goals of contractors can do pitifully little to have more of a say in setting the goals of their own research work. Writing in Physics Today, a monthly publication of the American Institute of Physics, with a wide circulation among physicists, Alfred H. Sommer shares the tricks he learned while working for over 40 years in 5 laboratories. A frequent problem is that your superior wants you to work on a project that you don't believe in, or conversely, does not want you to pursue the one that you think has potential. There's no simple solution to these problems, but I can make some useful suggestions. In the first case, if you have several projects going, it is often effective to ask the supervisor which of your projects should be dropped to make time for the new one. In the second case, it sometimes pays to work on your project during evenings and weekends, or when your supervisor is on vacation or in the hospital. Close quote. In light of the powerlessness that this description indicates, it becomes clear why many industrial scientists feel self-directed when their employers let them decide for themselves which of the company's commercial or military research topics to work on. Whether or not scientists who work in industry or government feel self-directed, they are not treated as such. Frank von Hippel, a prominent Princeton University physicist, notes that industry and government scientists are not even free enough to question the social value of their own assignments or their institution's work, which may be potentially cataclysmic. Von Hippel has advocated that the American Physical Society help develop legislation that would enable scientists to speak out with less risk. Quote, "It is likely that the protection of the freedom of speech of scientists and engineers in industry and government would have large social benefits. Technology has become so powerful that we can no longer afford to wait to correct a problem until we can count the bodies. The legislation would protect the employee from being rapidly railroaded out of his livelihood. It means also that he can get an impartial hearing. And finally, if the outside investigator or hearing board finds in his favor, then he has some protection against being blackballed in his search for another job." Close quote. The more one looks into it, the clearer it becomes that the scientist best suited for harmony in an industrial or government position is the one willing to accept direction uncritically in all but the narrow technical aspects of her research work. As a good professional, such a scientist accepts a research problem, tries to see it as an intriguing puzzle of captivating interest, and carries out the research with dedication. But what about university scientists? Unlike their colleagues who work in industry or in government laboratories, university scientists pursue their own intellectual interests. They are certainly not directed to serve profit, technology, or the military. Or are they? And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System that Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt, published in the year 2000. For those of you who are just joining the program and haven't heard any of these other readings, Jeff Schmidt himself was trained in physics at the University of California and worked as a writer and editor for the professional publication Physics Today. After 19 years, he was fired from his job subsequent to the publication of this book. Continuing on with the next subsection in Chapter 4, titled Directing the Professor's Curiosity. Do university scientists freely set the courses of their own careers? Or do outside forces lead them to enter particular subfields within their disciplines and to take up particular topics within those subfields? To ask the same question a different way, how much freedom do those who fund scientific research give to those who do scientific research? The federal government sponsors the bulk of the basic science research that goes on in U.S. universities. Most basic physics research at universities, for example, is sponsored by just four government agencies: the Department of Energy, successor of the Atomic Energy Commission, the National Science Foundation, the Department of Defense through the Army Research Office, the Office of Naval Research, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, and so on, and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. 99% of the federal funding for basic physics research at universities comes through these four agencies. In 1995, the federal government spent about $590 million on university physics research, About 455 million of that expenditure paid for research characterized as basic. At the University of California, Irvine, my old school, physics professors in 1996 got 8.7 million of their 10.2 million in R&D money from the federal government. To what extent do the university pipers themselves call the tune when the government pays for their work? The government, like any sponsor, is keenly aware of its influence and has known the answer to this question since the 1950s, when it began to dominate the funding of basic research in universities in the United States. In 1954, the President of the United States ordered the then 4-year-old National Science Foundation to report the effect that federal research money has on educational institutions. The resulting NSF report to the President, Government-University Relationships in Federally Sponsored Scientific Research and Development, addresses the question of directions explicitly. Quote, to what extent has the availability of funds from particular agencies given direction to research in the universities? Has the type of work done been determined by the availability of extra-university funds for certain kinds of research? NSF gives the answer to the president in scientistic language. Quote, it would be unrealistic to claim that federal contracts and grants for research at universities have exercised no influence over the types and fields of research undertaken by the institutions. For example, Agency X has funds for support of a given type of work. Professor A at University Y applies for the funds to carry on a project in the area, although he may be the only one in the school with interest in it, and these interests may have been furthered by the availability of the federal funds. He employs several research assistants. They are paid for aiding Professor A on the project, and in the process obtain advanced degrees. One of the assistants is very capable. He is taken on the staff as an instructor or even assistant professor. He, too, applies for support for the same type of work, and before long, University Y has a strong department in the particular area. One cannot conclude that the influence of Agency X was detrimental, but one can say that the agency did influence the direction of research at University Y and perhaps the number of young scientists with the particular research interest. Close quote. Clearly, the government understands not only that it influences the content of research at University Y, but that it also programs new scientists with particular research interests. Of course, it is already obvious from common sense and simple logic that when a government agency pumps research money into universities for work in areas of its own interest, it affects the kind of research that goes on, so that somewhere university scientists must be taking up topics they would not otherwise investigate. If, for example, a government agency makes $43.9 million available to universities for basic research in nuclear physics, then university physicists will do $43.9 million worth of basic research in nuclear physics. The government agency, for all practical purposes, will have ordered university physicists to do $43.9 million worth of basic research in nuclear physics. Although this is not the kind of order that names specific researchers, it is an order that individual university professors do end up carrying out. How aware are academics themselves of the outside influences on the topics they take up? Are they as aware as their sponsors? As the discussion moves from Agency X and Professor A and gets closer to home, university scientists show less and less understanding of the influence that others have on the work they do. They readily agree that the reason university science departments are bigger and do more research than, say, university philosophy departments, has more to do with the priorities of those who sponsor research than with the wishes of scientists and philosophers. With greater difficulty, the university scientist recognizes that much of the research in his or her own field and subfield owes its very existence to the priorities of the sponsors. Somehow, the influence of sponsors is easier to recognize in fields and subfields other than one's own. Finally, by asking individual scientists the extent to which they decide for themselves which topic to take up as their own, one often finds that the professors so savor the I am my own boss self-image that they are unwilling even to consider the possibility that they have less than total control. I have heard academics with defense agency funding put it like this: I am doing my research because I'm interested in it, not because the military directed me to do it. It just so happens that the Defense Department is paying for it. Close quote. The National Science Foundation knows better than to believe such claims. It sees the need to look beyond the usual statement the university scientists make when they are asked about the origins of their work. Quote, "The distinction between choices made because of genuine interests and curiosity of the staff members and those made because funds were available for a particular field is not easily drawn. Although the usual statement of the research staff is that they are doing work of their choice, the statement is in part offset by the parallel reply to the following question. If the same funds were available to a department without strings of any kind or interests of sponsoring agencies, except that the money be used for research, would the staff of the department be doing the same research?" The answers are often qualified. Close quote. If academics lack a clear understanding of how they are directed toward particular topics, that is in part because they are directed in ways that allow them to see themselves as self-directed. One of the most important of these ways is funding via the unsolicited proposal. University professors build their careers on research, not teaching. Many professors get the money that they need to do research by writing an outline of the work they propose to do and submitting it to a federal agency that funds research. This is the unsolicited proposal, and using it as a mechanism for funding would seem to give control of research topics to individual scientists, not to sponsors. However, even though writing such a proposal requires a huge amount of time and effort, funding is by no means assured. The National Science Foundation rejects 2 out of 3 proposals, as does the National Institutes of Health. And so professors who want money to do research inevitably have funding agencies' interests in mind as they plan their work and write their proposals. Consciously or unconsciously, they tailor their own interests to match those of the sponsors. Hence, a scientist's unsolicited request for money to work on a particular problem may represent the opposite of what it appears to represent. The scientist's research proposal may actually be an expression of the sponsor's desire that the scientist attack the particular problem. When academic staff members are asked if they initiated the research now done under contract, the usual answer is yes. However, further discussion may show that the project arose as a result of conversations or consultations with agencies having specific problems associated with their particular programs and objectives. It is to be expected that as an agency having particular interests would consult with scientists who have done work of interest to them, and this consultation may easily result in requests from the university staff members for support in their area of interest. Close quote. The professor who is very good at coming up with proposals that get funded is sometimes called a grantsman, particularly when the professor brings in enough money to hire a large staff of researchers. The name can be derogatory because it suggests a scientist who is concerned more with keeping the money flowing in and building an empire than with solving a particular research problem. With the unsolicited proposal, even university scientists whose research is paid for by the Defense Department can believe they are self-directed and that military need does not determine the content of their work. Even if the military pays for all the research that is being done on a particular topic, it is still practically impossible to prove that the availability of military money is why a particular professor is doing research on that topic. The federal government's great satisfaction with the work of scientists recruited into large-scale research and development projects during World War II laid the foundation for its heavy participation in basic research after the war. The government channeled much of the post-war financial support for basic science through the Office of Naval Research, which it established for that purpose in 1946. ONR, still very much in business, uses most of its money to back research proposals that it receives unsolicited. This allows academics to decide, like perfectly autonomous individuals, the topics of research work that they will do. The Navy need only provide the framework. Quote, although the contracts are usually awarded in response to unsolicited proposals, ONR makes every effort to publicize its research needs so that its programs and interests can be taken into account by prospective contractors. Clearly, a professor's insistence that her services were unsolicited should not lead one to conclude that her financial backers have given no direction to the content of her work. Like ONR, other major research funding agencies, such as the Army Research Office, the Air Force Office of Scientific Research, the National Science Foundation, and the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, fulfill a lot of their research needs simply by making their interests known and backing unsolicited proposals. Thus, the Army Research Office gives professors hints as to where the money is, and thereby allows them to modify their interests accordingly by publicizing its research interests in great detail and quietly mentioning that ARO receives approximately 700 proposals each year and historically funds approximately 200 new awards. Agencies are often quite specific about their interests. Quote, in optical physics, a rapidly growing part of the program, specific current interests include the nonlinear response of isolated atoms to intense, ultra-short electromagnetic fields, dot, dot, dot. That example is from the National Science Foundation's Guide to Programs, which NSF describes as a compilation of funding opportunities. The guide notes that NSF receives approximately 30,000 proposals each year and makes about 9,000 awards. Thus, funders find they can arouse the proper research interests in scientists without saying very much. Their money talks and is brilliantly articulate. And I've been reading from Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt, published in 2000 by Roman and Littlefield. I'm stopping at this point in the interests of time, but next week I'll go on to the next chapter. The balance of this chapter, Chapter 4, contains more examples of how research is overtly and covertly directed by funders, especially the military, but it's in a form that's hard to read on the radio. I think that Schmidt has more than proved his point in the material that has already been presented, but I encourage you to read the book for yourself. Our theme music on Welcome Guest is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening. Like an unwelcome.